Hi, everybody. Welcome to Columbia. Thanks for coming out here. Incidentally, did anybody hear about this through the Columbia announcements, or is everyone here associated with the BSBU? Okay, we've got one. Well, it was a great turnout. Thanks for coming by. We had a busy month, but who came to me first? Well, when Bug came to me and the ACM and needed somewhere to host this event, we couldn't say no with such eminent speakers. And a great turnout. Thanks so much. It's going to be a great event, and enjoy.
Okay, I'm just going to do a quick few introductory words. I'm George from the New York City BSD User Group. We started meeting last January, December, and we have monthly meetings first Wednesday of the month. We meet at the Apple Store at 103 Prince Street downtown. You can find it all on our website, nicebug.org. There's also a number of books that Drew Levine, the author of BSD Hacks, brought down from Ottawa. These were smuggled from Canada. These are all giveaway books that Drew has, so if anybody's interested. Additionally, we have a number of books. Some are from Nicebug, some are from BSD Mall to Sell. We're also raffling off a number of other books from Addison Wesley. There's a raffle, I think it's $1 a ticket, and we definitely encourage people. There's Kirk's book, Design Implementation, Free BSD Operating System. There's the Cheswick book on firewalls. Eric Raymond's book on the art of Unix programming. A whole number of books that, definitely want people to contribute to. And I guess the last thing is, let me just introduce. I mean, I guess if there's two names in the BSD world that don't need a lot of introduction, it's Eric Holman and Kirk McKusick. Nevertheless, I'll give you some background. Eric is kind of the man behind the whole history of SendMail. SendMail, which, people generally love it or hate it, but the reality is it still moves over, 70-some percent of the mail on the Internet. Eric has been around, been part of the open source community in the United States for a long time now, plays a fundamental role in organizations such as Usenix, and he's also been involved, most recently, in a lot of the debates about the sender ID controversy, which is based around a new anti-spam authentication header that we're looking to have added into SMTP. Now, Eric is going to be speaking about sender ID. Obviously, Eric could speak about a whole number of topics, but he's going to focus on sender ID. He's going to be speaking for about 30 minutes, then we'll open it up to questions and answers. Then Kirk is going to be speaking. Kirk McKusick has, been working on BSD since the 70s, I guess mostly in file systems, and he's going to be speaking basically about the history of BSD Unix, BSD, or asterisk Nix, whatever. Anybody from Scotia, here, sorry. It's not really Unix. But anyway, Kirk is going to speak, and it's actually going to be similar to a meeting that he did at Usenix this past year. Both Kirk and Eric are heavily involved in Usenix, which, if you don't know about Usenix, go to Usenix.org. I guess we can leave it there, and we'll let Eric start.
Yeah, well, one thing that got left out is that Kirk and I are also both on the editorial review board of ACMQ magazine, which is doing really well. I strongly recommend, if you don't know about it, you look at it. It's designed for people like you. We had our monthly editorial review board dinner last night. We held them in San Francisco, New York City. It was New York City's turn. And there's a lot of wine at these dinners. And this one ran a little late, mostly because after we finished dinner, a couple of us hung around and another bottle of wine. So you'll have to forgive me. My voice is a little buff here. I'm going to be talking about sender domain authentication, which will include sender ID, but also some other things. A little bit, not a long talk, but I'm happy to answer questions. Whatever, I think I've only got 8 slides, and this is the first of them. So, but one of the things I do want to talk about is politics associated with it, because the a lot of you probably know that sender ID went down in flames in the IETF. And I'll talk a little bit about what was going on there and what the implications of that are. Oh yes, That's right, I threw this in. I had to do this because I like to start out with something a little humorous. This is the traditional anti-spam talk. You know, you go to anti-spam conferences, which I go to a lot of, and you get these folks who come up and they do, you know, they're going to do a technical talk on spam. Unfortunately, they all have marketing in their title someplace or another. So the talk goes like this. There's three slides on what is spam anyway, because, of course, we don't know that, so they have to tell us. A couple slides explaining to everyone that spam is bad. Two more slides saying, no, it's really, really bad. And three slides, it's getting worse. Did I mention how bad it is? One slide. If we don't fix spam, this is the threatening talk. If we don't fix spam, all of London will be buried underneath 25 feet of spam by 2104.
Is that bad or good?
That's a matter of opinion. This, by the way, is a takeoff of somebody actually did predict in, you know, 18 or something that all of London would be buried underneath 25 feet of horse manure because of the number of horses in the street. So that was a real thing. And of course, you've got to have some nice clip art with this one. And by the way, it's really, really, really bad. And the sky is falling. Got to do something immediately. And if you just buy my product, all of your problems will be solved because we have solved the spam problem. There's 17 slides there, at least one slide of which is nothing more than a great big huge graphic filled with the logos of all of your partners and customers. Anyway, so much for that one. I'm assuming you all know what spam is. If you don't, just take a nap until Kirk's talk comes up. We know that spam is continuing, unabated. Phishing in particular, the form of spam is, you know, basically trying to do identity theft or you know, some kind of actual theft. Leveraging on spam is really exploding right now. It's turning into a major problem for a lot of companies. You know, people are highly motivated to get this stuff fixed, which is actually good because with motivation, maybe we'll actually get people to get off their butts and do something. What we've been using traditionally has been filter out. That is to say, you know, all the mail gets to me unless I decide it's spam, at which point I throw it away or quarantine it or something like that. This is the standard, you know, filtering. Bayesian filters are all like this, et cetera, et cetera. But there are distinct limits to filtering things out, as probably most of you know. And one thing that people seem to be reluctant to understand is that even if you get your filter-out approach to, let's say, 99% effective, so only one spam in 100 is getting through, as spam increases, that 1% is still going to get to be a large number. And I'm getting about, I don't know, 12 to 1,500 spams a day. And so even at 99%, I'd get 12 to 15, and I can assure you I'm not at 99% effective. There's a lot of people who are pushing toward what's sometimes called filter-in approaches, otherwise known as permission-based, as in you need to have permission in order to get mail through to me. This is the simplest versions of these are things like active spam killer, ASK, challenge response kind of systems. If you will, you gain permission by responding to some kind of challenge. There's a lot of ways to get permission. I'm not going to talk about all of those because they vary dramatically. The problem with any of the filter-in approaches, though, at least those based on identity, which almost all of them are, that's to say the email address of the sender, is that without authentication, anyone can claim to be anyone they want. And so if the bad guy can predict who's in my whitelist or allow list, then they just pretend to be one of those. Based on the spam that I'm getting and who they claim to be from, a shockingly large number of them are from people who might well be on my allow list. You know, now some of these are very old addresses. You know, I still get spam from Dennis Ritchie at Bell Labs. The only thing is he's retired for several years and isn't there. And besides which, I really don't think Dennis would be spamming me. It's just a hunch. So you need some kind of authentication in order for these things to be useful. So the conclusion of this is that authentication is necessary to get sort of this new class of anti-spam algorithms enabled. I want to emphasize that authentication by itself is not anti-spam. It helps phishing substantially, but it is not anti-spam. And the number of people who come up to me and say, "What good is authentication? Of you know, they've just authenticated themselves." It is true today that that more spammers correctly authenticate using spammer sender ID than non-spammers. That is to say, the spammers have already set up so that they're sending from authenticated addresses, although it's still spam, because they're hoping somebody will be stupid enough to assume that because it's authenticated, it's good. Never confuse authentication with permission. There is an authentication is somewhat hard to do. People, you know, PGP and S/MIME are around today. They've been around forever. Almost nobody uses them on any kind of routine basis. They're hard to use for various reasons, mostly having to do with key management. PGP and S/MIME use different key models, but they both have substantial deployment problems. PGP in particular is actually really good for geeks like us, but just does not play, for example, in the corporate world very well. But we do have a simplifying assumption. You only need to authenticate the domain part of an address, because if you can push it back to a domain, that's in some sense good enough. So, for example, if something comes out as being from anyone at sendmail.com, and you can prove it came from sendmail.com, then at least you know who to blame, and we have assisted men who will be all over that like mad, because he hates spam as much as anyone. So there's two basic classes. This is just kind of a quick overview of the technology. Two classes of algorithms that are being used for authentication. The first is IP address based, which is the one that's gotten the most airtime. The concept is simple. When you, the recipient, gets a connection and the mail claims to be from, let's say, example.com, then you go, you ask example.com, typically by doing a DNS query, what the set of IP addresses it will send mail from. If the connection is from one of those IP addresses, then you know it probably is indeed from example.com. If it's not, then you don't have that kind of assurance. Now, it doesn't necessarily mean it's fake, unfortunately, but I'll get into that in a little bit. This is a very nice property for the senders, is that IP-based things typically only require adding a record into DNS. There's no additional software that needs to be installed on the sender's end, anything like that. Of course, in the receiver has to have the extra software to actually do the DNS lookup and do the comparison. So somebody's got to actually do something. Cryptography-based is the other scheme. This is actually quite a bit stronger from a technology perspective, and it also doesn't have a lot of the quirks, difficulties that IP address-based schemes have. These are just simple cryptographic signatures. Now, the proposals vary in what gets signed, you know, like is it the entire message or just the header or the body and some of the headers or, you know, so forth and so on. And they vary in, you know, canonification algorithms and that kind of thing. The concept, of course, is simple. When example.com gets a connection, mail claims to be from, or somebody gets a connection, mail claims to be from example.com, then you go ask example.com, not for their list of IP addresses, but for their public key. What this means is you don't need certificate authorities and that sort of thing. So it's actually very easy to do key management in this case, unlike S/MIME, where you do start to have to go up training with trees of certs and look at CRLs and yuck. So honest senders here now have to add that DNS record, but they also have to install the software necessary to do the actual signing of the message. Typically at the gateway, by the way, not at the desktop, is another attractive feature. I was at an IAB, Internet Architecture Board workshop, I guess it was last week, and got people from, you know, the VoIP crowd and security folks and various kinds of IAM and so forth, talking about what the, you know, the future of Internet messaging. And it was observed that by one of the security guys who works for a company that sells security solutions, that, you know, we've already got S-MIME, it's well deployed all over the place, but even in his own company, the company that makes this stuff, they don't use it on any kind of regular basis. This was in response to somebody who said it's got to be one click to get security. He says, no, it's got to be zero click. The nice thing about these properties is that both of these, they're zero click from the point of view of the end user. and this is just reiterating what I said before. In both cases, the authentication only tells you that the address is not a forgery. But beyond that, I don't know, you know, one of you could be an axe murderer in here, and just showing me your driver's license doesn't tell me I should trust you. I mentioned this before in a little more detail. What gets authenticated? One of the big issues is it the address contained in the envelope, that is, say, the SMTP mail from command, which is really cheap and easy to get. It's right there in the SMTP protocol. You can get it before you even read the message. So if you're going to do a rejection, you can do it without having to chew up the bandwidth and that sort of thing. But the envelope is used for automated bounces. It's never intended to go to the end user, and often, in fact, is not the same as the header from. For example, anything that goes through a mailing list in general will have a different envelope from than header from, and this is completely, utterly reasonable and common today. So personally, I don't like things that authenticate the envelope because I just don't see that it really wins much. The other, of course, is the address in the header, and you know, there's multiple addresses, sender addresses in the header, so there's some question about what that really means. The purest solutions just look at the from header, but it turns out there's some issues there, so most of them look at from and sender, and then like sender ID also looks at resent from and resent sender. But all of those are available. User agents have them. You could potentially display them, although most UAs today do not. So the end user then, okay, some other issues is what does the end user actually see? One big problem that's been pointed out is that authentication validates the address, the user at domain, not the so-called display name. So, for example, there's no reason I couldn't send something from Citibank customer service bracket eric@fishers.com. And what's the end user going to see? From Citibank customer service. This is not true of all MUAs, but some of them. So this is an issue that's got to get fixed. So there is work on the UA side, no matter what, and that's unfortunate because it takes forever to get UAs deployed, but it's got to start happening. As I said, the envelope is only visible in the return path header, and systems are not always even consistent about putting the return path header in. Most header lines, of course, are not displayed, even when you actually look at the message. Well, again, under most user agents, typically you have a way to look at them if you want to. There's some way to say, you know, show me all the garbage, and it will do that, but my mom isn't going to do that. One thing you could do, by the way, at least as an interim thing, though, is that the server could modify the subject line on delivery, or even the display name on the from to say, for example, is it authenticated or not, or, you know, some warning to the end user. So, in fact, this is not an insoluble problem in any sense. Another issue, which you might have picked up on the last slide, is that there has to be a way to distinguish between senders that are participating and senders that are not. So, In particular, if you get something that, for example, does not have a message that does not have a signature in it, does that mean that the sender simply is not signing their messages, or does it mean that they are signing them and this is a fake? You actually have to go back to the sender anyway just to find out, are they participating in it? And there have been schemes that have been proposed that sort of left out this little bit, and there was no way to determine if they were participating or not. But I think most people figured that out by now. There's a lot of little sand traps you can get into here. By the way, if you've got any questions, please feel free to interrupt me. I'll take questions at the end, but I'm happy to answer them in the middle. Some of the technical problems. The address-based schemes break naive forwarding. That's a forwarding that does not modify the sender address, whichever sender address is being authenticated by that scheme. So in particular, if you've got an acm.org email address, which is really a forwarding address, if I send to you there, and that forwards it off to your real mailbox where you're going to read it, when you get it to your real mailbox, an address, the connection is going to come from an acm.org machine, not from the original sender's machine, and any of the IP address-based schemes will go, wait, there's something wrong. that is, of course, completely ordinary behavior today. People forward or alias or that sort of thing all the time. And so this is not a bug. It's a design decision, a feature of store and forward email. There have been people who have gone and said, well, that's a bug. You should never forward mail, ever. I can't take such an extreme position. Maybe I'm just too old. There are proposals to fix these that vary. The sender ID, for example, the proposal to fix is actually pretty elegant and involves using resent headers instead of other things. But, for example, SPF, the solution in SPF is an algorithm that I'm not even sure even its mother could love, although I know that's not true because there is a guy who swears it's beautiful and elegant and whatnot. It is grotesque. Just awful. And I have good reason to believe that under normal day-to-day vanilla circumstances, it actually breaks internet standards. Not in major ways, but just enough to cause serious worry. Another issue with address-based schemes is that senders that have dynamic IP addresses, like DSL without a static IP, they don't know in advance what their address is going to be, so it's kind of hard to keep up with this. The usual approach here is just to go through a mail server. You authenticate to the mail server using one of the existing schemes, such as SMTP authentication or TLS, Transport Layer Security, and then that one will forward it. And so, since that's got a fixed static IP address, you can use that. And this, people are doing this increasingly for a lot of reasons, including to avoid IP blacklists. A lot of service providers are blocking, for example, port 25, particularly like. Go to a hotel now, and they're almost always going to either block or hijack port 25 because they don't want you checking into a room and then sending out a pile of spam, which would be really quite trivial to do. A lot of evidence that people actually do this. They go to, free Wi-Fi hotspots and send spam while they're having their cappuccino. The crypto-based solutions have a different set of problems. On the whole, I think these are more manageable. The sad reality of the day is that messages do sometimes get munged in various ways during transit. There's both good and not so good reasons why this happens, but it's very real. It's much less real than it was a few years ago. And I'm inclined to think that we can make it go away in the long run. But until it goes away, there's two approaches that are used. One is to find canonification algorithms or canonicalization algorithms that essentially munge the, internally when they're generating and checking the signature, munge it into some sort of canonical form so that vanilla transformations will go away. For example, Domain Keys has a canonicalization algorithm called NoFWS, which says essentially ignore all folding white space when you're generating the signature. Because white space tends to be stuff, you know, tabs get turned to spaces, or new lines get wrapped, but they'll get wrapped at white space, that sort of thing. Mailing lists, in particular, almost always modify the header of a message. I skipped encapsulation. Encapsulation is where you essentially turn every message into a MIME message, you Base64 encoded or something like that, so that the standard algorithms that are likely to modify the message will still be semantically the same, and with Base64 it will decode to the same thing, so everything's cool. Mailing lists, of course, almost always modify the body of the header. They put a list ID in or something like that. But the real model of a mailing list is that you deliver to the mailing list, or actually the mailing list agent, which then in turn resubmits the message, and hence it ought to re-sign the message when it resubmits. So that's the right model. Of course, they don't do this today, but at least there's like a body of software that you can point at and go, you have to do this. So, what's the state of the world? There are several address-based approaches out there. Probably the one that's, the two that are best known are Sender ID from Microsoft and SPF from Mengwang Wang. The Microsoft version that exists, there are implementations out there. There's some deployment. As I said, spammers are putting more sender ID authentication records in the legitimate senders so far, but that can change. No biggie. The big problem with it is that Microsoft has a patent application. I guess that should be very clear. A patent application on some of the concepts in sender ID. When the whole thing was going on in the Merid working group inside the ITF, they wouldn't even release the patent itself, which, of course, nobody knew what it was claiming, and it's a little hard to make any rational arguments on the basis of something where you know the existence but not the content of a patent. It was then later released because they wanted to also file for European, I guess, EU patent, and the EU does not allow you to file patents without making them public, so it became public at that point. I'm going to talk on the next slide, I think it is, on a little bit more about that patent and what the implications of that are. Sender ID, even though the ICF is not pursuing it at this time, they're first of all going to take internet drafts, and they're intending to publish them as experimental RFCs. Which means that they will be out there and published, but they're not on the standards track. Experimental says, hey, why don't you play with this, because we need to get more operational experience with it before we can decide whether to drop it or put it onto the standards track. Now, of course, the intellectual property issues are going to have to be dealt with before the ICF will go along with it. SPF also exists. There's moderate deployment of it. A bunch of people are using it. The main problem in my mind with SPF is it validates the envelope rather than the header, and that makes it just not all that useful. Yes.
What is SPF?
SPF is SPF. It used to be sender permitted from, but Meng, one of the arguments in favor of caller ID, which is sender ID, I should say, was intended as a merge between caller ID, which was the original Microsoft proposal, and SPF. And one of the caller ID was explicitly a policy document. It was an XML-encoded policy document that had much more information about the mail system. In fact, it was probably, there were some technical problems with it, but it was probably better thought out as a long-term thing. So, and Meng's was really just about the authenticating the envelope sender. So Meng's solution to this was to change the meaning of SPF from sender permitted from to sender policy framework. So he says, see, it is a policy language. Meng's a very, very bright guy. I really do want to give him credit for that, but he's really young and awfully stubborn. And, you know, I have seen him, I've personally argued with him and stuff, saying, this doesn't work. And I can tell you exactly why it doesn't work. And he goes, oh, yeah, okay, but then he does it anyway. Which drives me nuts. As I say, SPF is similar to sender ID. It would be actually fairer to say that sender ID is similar to SPF because it was, in fact, it explicitly brought in ideas from SPF as well as caller ID. The ITF, when they decided to cancel MERID, basically they've abandoned all IP address-based schemes, which actually, to me, is okay. Because, frankly, I just don't think they're technologically strong. Faster to deploy, which is the good part about them, but they're not the preferred technical approach. I should say, to be fair, by the way, I'm a co-author on one of the sender ID drafts. So believe it or not, I probably shouldn't say this at this meeting, but I've been working with Microsoft. let me give Microsoft some due credit here. The people that I've been working with one exception, have been great. I mean, really, really good. They really understand. I literally had a phone call one day wherein somebody, a fairly senior person at Microsoft, said, and I quote, "We cannot do this without you." I've never heard Microsoft admit that they couldn't do anything.
And now that was careful.
Sorry?
Now watch out.
Yeah, exactly. No, believe me, I'm... the person in question was the lawyer where we were trying to convince them that the patent license had problems. Get to that on the last slide. And she was just like, no. No, we just don't do things that way here. We're Microsoft and you're not. Get used to it, more or less. she said a little nicer than that, but not a lot nicer. Cryptographic approaches, the main one out here is domain keys, which was proposed by Mark Delaney from Yahoo. Mark, as it turns out, used to work at Sendmail. So we've actually been working with them actually before we got into any of the IP-based approaches. It exists, and there's some deployment. It is worth noting that as of, I think, the 15th, which is yesterday, I guess, Gmail is now signing all of their outgoing mail. This is going to be a tremendous boost for domain keys. So I actually kind of like it. I'm told that it's currently being merged with Cisco's proposal, IIM, which stands for Identified Internet Mail. I have no idea what that's going to look like. They have not shared that with us yet. There's a working group. Actually, it's not a working group. It's technically a bot, Birds of a Feather, at the ITF called MASS, I'm sorry. I can't remember what MASS stands for. It's, shall we delicately say, it's under a lot of discussion right now, which is to say that there's a lot of mail on the mailing list, and it's virtually content-free.
Why do you think that Gmail signing will help so much?
Because one of the big arguments, it's like the network effect. Nobody wants to be the first one. There's a major fear, I think unwarranted, but a major fear that cryptography is so expensive that doing, signing all of email will bring the entire internet to its knees. I actually had somebody saying, if we have to compute a signature on every piece of email, it will be 5 orders of magnitude slower, 10 to the fifth, to which I say, and what planet are you living on?
If 95% of the mail is going around in spam, then you eliminate that, you've got lots of recycles.
Yeah, well, and the other two things. One is, I think it was under the mistaken impression that when you do asymmetric cryptography, public key cryptography, that you actually run that huge, big num algorithm on the whole message. You don't. You compute a hash of the message, which is computationally very simple, and then sign that hash. The other thing is, crypto chips are out there. They're coming down rapidly in price. There's lots of reasons to use crypto these days, I predict it will be a very short period of time before your standard motherboard just has a crypto chip on it. And they can be nice and fast, just like your standard motherboard has an Ethernet chip on it now. It didn't used to, guys. You had to buy a separate card. That's why there were, 200 PCI slots on a backplane, because you needed one for your graphics card, which is now on the motherboard, one for your Ethernet, which is now on the motherboard, one for your serial card, now on the motherboard, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So, Microsoft, as I said, has a patent covering sender ID. It's quite broad, so broad that I have my doubts that it's they're going to actually get the patent, or at least it would be dramatically cut down before they get it. It probably, however, does cover SPF. The good news is that Microsoft is in fact giving away. They've got a license that's on their web page. A free, royalty-free, perpetual license to use any of the intellectual property rights embodied in the patents in order to implement sender ID. Okay, so anyone can go and do that. The bad news is it's not sublicensable, which basically makes it incompatible with several open-source licenses. Now, I actually published something where, based on my reading of some previous things where I thought it was not incompatible, and I still have some scars on my body to show for that one. I do think I was consistent with what has been published in the past. It's very clear that the open source world is not going to budge on this one any more than Microsoft's going to budge. So we do have kind of a stalemate here. Until such time as Microsoft does not get the patent, at which point. That'll be like 15 years, though. So, what does it mean?
What does it mean to have a free license to use the patent, but it's not sublicensable?
Free license to use means you can make, use, or sell an implementation of sender ID without having to pay anything to Microsoft. But if I, for example, implement it in SendMail, then FreeBSD has to themselves go get a license from Microsoft before they can redistribute it. I cannot give them a license which allows
free
them
license.
To, in turn.
They
have to get a free license.
They have to ask Microsoft for a free license.
Right. And the politics of this are quite amazing. There's actually been claims that, well, what Microsoft is actually saying is, don't bother getting it. Their view is it's a purely defensive license to prevent them from getting sued, and there is absolutely no way they can do that if it's sublicensable, which is interesting because Yahoo also has a patent covering domain keys. They have also done a perpetual royalty-free license, which is sublicensable. So either Microsoft's lawyers know something that Yahoo's do not, or the other way around. Yes?
That's a clarification. Not only that it's sublicensable, every end user that uses technology has to buy the license?
No, end users do not. You can make, use, and sell. Sell means that people are allowed to get it and use it. It's only, the license is only necessary if you're doing a distribution of the code. So anyone who's doing a distribution has to, but anyone can get it and use it without having to go get a separate license.
So the distribution is anyone handing someone else a copy of the program?
You betcha.
Okay. So in our sense, it's everyone.
Yes, in your sense.
So we think of as being the end user.
Right.
It's someone who runs a compiler. It's someone who hands a copy.
No. If my mom downloads a copy of something that implements sender ID, she can run it all she wants. She does not have to go to Microsoft for anything. Now, if she decides that she wants to give one of her friends a copy, then she now has to go to get a license in order to be able to do that redistribution. Of course, you could tell her friend just to go back to the original place and get it, but that's not the way.
The Microsoft sense of private property is that you get a program from them and you move it from one machine of yours to another, or from one hard drive of yours to another, and that's somehow a new thing requiring a new license. Or your mom does it and gives it to your dad, and that the new party, who he has no rights in the matter because she's only agreed to it. That's their concept, right?
Moving it from disk to disk does not reassign ownership, so no, that does not. However, if she gives a copy to my dad, which is highly unlikely on my dad, then that could be construed perhaps as a redistribution. Obviously not going to that Microsoft probably is not going to sue my mom over this stuff, which is one of the reasons why people are saying, well, what if they can't get any? They can't. There's no damages. So why would they sue anyone? What possible reason would they have to do this? So just ignore the license. Don't sign it. Go ahead and redistribute it. And maybe I'm too conservative or whatever. I can't quite see intentionally not signing a license that I know is there and, you know, so forth. Yeah, exactly. There was a question over here at some point. But, okay. Sorry, say again. We were using my mom in a highly figurative term. I don't think she knows what a compiler is. I shouldn't say. Yahoo, as I said, also has patents applied for. They are not published, so it's unclear what it is they cover. However, they also have that license, which does allow sublicensability. So now we get into the interesting question of people are, like in the IETF and open source worlds, let's just say they're feeling hypersensitive right now. And there's some people who say, if there is any intellectual property right, I don't care if they're going to let me use it and redistribute it and so forth for free. Even though you can do anything you want, I'm fundamentally opposed to the concept of software patents. If there's any software patent associated with this, then no, we shouldn't use it. My take is that's pretty limiting. Let's just put it that way. There's not a lot you can do in the world where you're not going to bump into somebody's software patent these days. Companies do them for, we've got patents, I don't think anyone at my company likes software patents any more than you folks do, but the reality is if somebody else comes to us and say, hey, you're violating our patent, we need some stuff in our patent portfolio, so we can say, well, yeah, maybe we are, but we can't help but notice that you're violating our patent too, so let's just swap patent rights. And that's the way the game's played these days. And that's the concept of defensive patenting.
What's the value of common law patents? Are they trying to use those?
Common law patents, I suspect in this field, anytime there's money involved, I would not be willing to rely on common law. Honestly, I'm not a lawyer. I try to avoid playing one on the net, but I just don't know that much about common law patents, but they don't feel good to me. That.
Okay. I don't know if you want to go too deep. Is that a non-revocable patent license?
Yes, non-revocable. Okay. That's not quite true. Sorry. There is a clause, and this is the protective thing. If you sue the issuer of the patent or any, in fact, I think both of them say any user of the patent, then your rights under the patent automatically terminate.
So it's like the Apache license.
It's like the Apache license, yeah.
And the second question is, no one was defined, what is a common law patent? Should we care?
Kurt? Wouldn't want to upset it, would you? There you go. Realistically, I don't know enough about common law patents to really be able to effectively answer that. So there's apparently free open internet access in here. Have somebody Google common law patent for you, then let me know. Yes, important point. In both of these cases, the license to use the patent apply only to implementing that particular standard. So Microsoft grants rights to use its patents in order to implement sender ID, but not to do anything else, which is one of the reasons why the open source people really don't like it. Ditto, Yahoo's patent grants you rights to implement domain keys, but not to do anything else with the IPR in the patent. has an interesting effect that if the Microsoft patent, for example, covers SPF, it might be considerably less risky to use sender ID than to use SPF, because since they haven't granted you any rights to use the intellectual property embodied in the patent to implement SPF, they can sue you. But as long as you sign that the license, they can't sue you in order to implement color ID or sender ID. So, neither of those patents are issued. As I said, the Yahoo one isn't even published. Having read the Microsoft patent, once again, I'm not a lawyer, but if we're not a lawyer, I sure do read a lot of legal language these days. And it looks to me like there's got to be a ton of prior art on it. But that's the standard game in the patent world. You claim everything, and then you basically argue back, you know. So it's a negotiation. By the way, did you know there's a patent on the linked list? Anybody, by the way, ever implemented a linked list in this room? You did go pay the royalties there, because that's not a free license. You guys did all pay the royalties, right? Just checking. I wanted to make sure there's no one in here.
That raises me. I know Microsoft's been in the games getting all their patent uses and trying to apply the patents.
Yeah, and by the way, the Microsoft engineers hate it. Because they're lawyers that come around and say, what are you working on right now? Oh, patent that. And it's like, I got work to do, right? No, take a week and write it up. It's like, but I'm on a schedule. Nope, sorry, this trumps.
What's their point? I mean, do they see the internet, or mail on the internet in the next 5 years being a whole series of interconnected exchange boxes? Spam free? What are they looking for?
I think there's some of that, but by and large, it's all very much intended to be protective. Microsoft gets sued all the time. I mean, they get multiple lawsuits filed against them every single day. And, a lot of them are, you stole my idea. Okay, and so, having a big patent portfolio lets you kind of do these swapping things around. And, of course, sometimes you get into the big cases like, SCO has just unearthed all kinds of stuff. But, in this case, it's a good thing that IBM has a huge patent portfolio because they seem to be working in the community's best interest right now. And if they didn't have that big patent portfolio, they would be in a much weaker position against SCO than they are. And that's why corporations do this stuff. There are rare cases where somebody comes up with something that is really so good that they really want to pursue it. But, it costs a lot to file those things, and in general, there's very little to achieve from them.
And do you think there's kind of an inverse relationship between the decline of open standards and that world that we knew, say, 10 years ago, that was a very, the kind of driving force and direction, and the patents? I mean, that's pretty clear that they're going in opposite directions, right? The decline of open standards and inclusion.
Yeah, well, here you get into the letter of the law and the reality of the world. Frankly, right now, if I were starting over again, I don't know if I'd go into software, because it just seems like every time you turn around, it's more about law today than it is about technology. If I wanted to be a lawyer, I would have gone to law school. as I say, most companies aren't litigating. It would be actually... my boss, Dave Anderson, the CEO of Sendmail, was at a conference and talked to Bill Gates about sender ID. And Bill Gates said that was the worst publicity black eye that Microsoft has ever gotten in the history of the company. It apparently just trashed them. And, to go out and say, for Microsoft to come along and sue Joe's garage and software shop because Microsoft comes along and says, we've got a patent on the bite and we can't help but notice that you're using the bite. Pay up, what's the press gonna do with that? So in general they will avoid doing that simply because it's not true that there's no such thing as bad publicity. There is such thing as bad publicity. Having gotten some myself, I can assure you of that. By the way, some of that bad publicity that Microsoft got, even though I'm presumably on Microsoft's side, I have this annoying thing, drives the marketing department nuts, and I tend to tell the truth about things. And so I was asked to write up, I was interviewed by eWeek and email interview, and to be honest, I never should have done this. It was kind of stupid, but I said something like, it will take an act of whatever deity it is that Microsoft worships to get them to back down on this. That apparently made it to Bill Gates' desk. I am told that he's not my best friend right now.
I had some serious apologizing to do after that one. And,
as you probably all know, the whole IPR issue is not these, but the whole concept of IPR in ICF. It actually came up, about 7 or 8 years ago, and Microsoft did, the IETF, there's actually a, I think it's an RFC, which is the intellectual property policy with the IETF. I don't remember the number, but it's easy to find if you want to say. And they basically said, it is okay to standardize stuff where there is IPR, outside IPR, as long as that's clearly stated, so people know what they're getting into if they implement, and it is reasonable for a working group to choose an unencumbered technology over an encumbered technology, should they care to.
But this is really blowing up right now. There's a lot of weird stuff going on in the ICF.
All I can predict on this is that blood is going to get shed. It's going to be a really exciting time, particularly if you're an IPR lawyer. or play one on the net, which a lot of people do these days. That's it. Any questions? Any other questions? Yeah. Gray listing. Actually, that's a really interesting question. Gray listing is, at least the way I'm using it, is where you, if you get email from an address that you haven't seen before, you temp fail the message. So you say, I won't accept it now, but please, you know, you're invited to come along and try again later. And then when they come along later, you can go ahead and accept it. Remarkably effective against spam. It's not perfect, but, you know, I've had cases where my home DSL line, for example, goes down, you know, because of, you know, one of the usual problems. And, you know, first time it happened, it was down for, I've changed providers, so I guess I'll just go ahead. It was down for like a day. What I was paying, it shouldn't have been down for a day. And I was expecting to just get tons and tons of email when I got in. It's like piddling nothing. You know, there was some. But the thing is, spam engines don't have queues. It's obvious when you think about it. Queues are hard to implement. They're hard to manage. And they're not well suited to hit and run spamming environments. So basically, if you say, coming back later, they won't come back later. So I think it's actually an interesting technology to use in conjunction with some of these others. Yes?
I would like to get like a receipt when I send mail. I mean, right now what I do is I usually use the verbose option and see it go to the site.
Mm-hmm.
But nowadays I don't even know if it takes it. You know, it just takes it, whatever.
Do you know about success DSNs? Delivery status notifications. That's the status notification when it gets delivered or forwarded to a mailing list or whatever.
Send
Microsoft? No, that's ICF. It's implemented in Send Mail. It's implemented lots of places. So I did hear, though, from Steve Hull, who's done a lot of work on bill presentation, once again at the IAB workshop, that there are some servers that advertise that, yes, indeed, I will, in the SMTP greeting, they say, yes, I do DSNs, but then they don't. So you will sometimes get things that just go into a black hole.
So, can you do that from the user agent?
From the user agent. Some, yes, but, you know, I can't speak about your user agent. The other one is MDNs, message delivery notifications, which are a end-to-end request basically, to send a read receipt. So DSNs are delivery receipts. MDNs are read receipts. But once again, the receiving MUAs have the right to just say, well, like, for example, mine prompts me, do you want to send the receipt? And in fact, I almost never do.
I don't want to piss anyone.
Sorry, you don't?
Oh, I don't want to upset someone. You know, they read the mail,
right,
and then...
Yeah, well, because sometimes I read it and then say, look, I'm going to come back to this later. I want plausible deniability.
Yeah.
I was just going to ask that on a kind of bigger picture sense, do you see more, different web applications taking the place in some cases of mail on a scale that's notable? I mean, just kind of dropping mail altogether in favor of...
Well, of course there's webmail. Okay, and people are... I mean, I find webmail almost universally difficult to use. And the other thing is it doesn't work very well when you're on an airplane. Airplanes seem to be when I get most of my time to read email. But Gmail in particular is one that people are saying, hey, somebody's actually like started to get a user interface that actually works in webmail. So you may see more of that kind of thing. There's been the whole question of dropping SMTP entirely and going to a pull model. SMTP is a push model. Pull models, once again, have problems where disconnected mode just doesn't work. A pure pull model probably doesn't work for the same reason that POP and IMAP have problems, in that people set their mail readers, for example, to check for new email every 15 seconds. Now imagine that scaled up the entire internet where every site is connecting to every other site every 15 seconds saying, hey, do you happen to have any mail for me? So you need some kind of notification to from one end to the other that, hey, there is mail, maybe you want to come read it. And that's a push. So the pull solutions are actually push-pull, not pure pulls.
I was actually thinking more along the lines of threaded messaging systems and just other, people moving to perhaps more closed social environments online that enable very, very clear communication.
Actually, one of the people at this workshop was a social networking person, and there was, in fact, a fair discussion of where that goes. I don't think anyone really knows yet. Some people really, really love social networks. Some people, you know, there are problems with social networks. I've got an Orkut account, but I haven't looked at it in 5 months, probably, in large part because it makes it way too easy for somebody to send mail to friends of a friend. I get enough mail as it is. I don't need people I don't even know sending me email saying, hey, why don't you come to my party? Which, by the way, is on the other side of the continent from where I am, and it's just not, you know, come on, guys. But I think the issue, the permission-based mail, the big question is how do you get permission? One of the proposals for how you get permission is you ask for introductions. So in other words, I do this with Q all the time, for example. You know, we think of somebody who would like to write an article and whatnot. I happen to know them personally. Obviously, they don't know the publisher, who's the one who actually does all the hard work. So I send them an email saying, hey, I'm looking at this for Q. You know, this is the guy. Are you interested? This is the guy to talk to and whatnot. And that usually works pretty well. That's, you know, remember when you used to, you know, in Japan even today, you have to have an introduction before you can get in, even in a business setting. You just cannot walk into a company in Japan and ask for a meeting. It doesn't happen. Same kind of thing is likely to be happening in email. Actually, I should go over to this side of the room because I've ignored. Yeah.
Right. This is more of a philosophical question, email is still around with the internet. I mean, you say it's the web, but really it's email. Being able to contact anyone in the world instantly or almost instantly relative to any other communication medium that's available via text. And it just seems to me that anti-spam systems, I mean, while spam is bad and terrible and useless, it's the only thing that spam systems is creating something that stops people from email and replaces something else.
There is a strong sentiment that the stuff that we're doing for spam is actually hurting the email world. And to a certain extent, I absolutely cannot deny that. And when I started writing send mail, one of the reasons I was writing, well, the big reason was because I needed to basically connect multiple networks together. It has been claimed, not by me, but it might be true, that send mail was the first inter-network, lowercase I, mail program. Could be true. But the other thing was I was sick and tired of hearing people say the computer ate my homework. And, mail was not reliable. And so one of the big goals for SendMail, one of the prime things, I was a database guy back then, and in databases, the one thing you must never, ever, absolutely, positively never do is lose somebody's data. You know, they'll draw and quarter you for that. And I took the same attitude toward email, which means, you know, you've got to check the results of a persistent call and all that stuff. It's painful. So the rule was mail became reliable. That is to say, it would either get delivered or you'd get a bounce saying that it did not get delivered and hopefully why. Well, who reads bounces anymore? Right? Effectively, what we've done is we've said email is no longer reliable. And I think that's a major step backwards, which is one of the reasons why people want, you know, read receipts and that kind of stuff, because now they feel they need a positive acknowledgement from the other end that it really did get through. And in particular, if you look at things like financial industry and whatnot, there are SEC, for example, requirements that before you can send, you know, a statement by email, you know, presumably if the user requests it, but you cannot assume that it's been delivered until you get some positive acknowledgement that they have in fact gotten it. Okay, arguably this is good because the law says once they drop a printed statement in the mail, it is legally delivered. It doesn't matter if it gets to the other end or not, which is a little weird because, you know, stuff does happen to mail. But we are probably rightfully demanding more out of email. So you've actually got these things tugging in opposite directions, one needing more reliable email and one needing somewhat less. As for the being able to contact anyone you want to without any prior introduction and so forth, I think there are ways to do that, but it's going to be more work for people. So challenge response, for example, doesn't require a trusted third party, but it does require that the sender, an initial sender who's never talked to somebody before, is going to have to be prepared to do an additional step. It's probably an acceptable cost, given the cost of spam. So, yeah.
What about a fast track for GDP violations reporting?
For what violations?
For reporting. When you get a spam, if there's no real procedure to say, theoretically, you can send to abuse, but it doesn't, I'm an admin.
There's a, I'm sure you've heard of the ASTA Alliance, which is AOL, Flint, Yahoo, Microsoft, Comcast, BT, and one other. One of the topics that they're talking about is, I have worked with them some, is exactly that, reporting in particular. What they're looking at is how do service providers share this information without at the same time compromising the privacy of their users, which is, when you think about it, actually a pretty hard problem. So there is work being done in that area. I can't claim to really know anything about it. It's not my bailiwick. Yeah?
One of the worst forms of spam is embedded spam. That is where a message is intercepted en route and the spam is injected inside a message as opposed to, you know, one where you read the subject line or see who it's from. I don't know where all my spam is coming from, but the two most clearly identified sources of the largest amount of spam are Microsoft and Yahoo. And they're coming in from Hotmail and MSN and Yahoo.com, and they're sticking advertisements for Yahoo in the message. I'm completely disoriented by your talk where you're talking about solutions to spam being proposed by the spammers.
I think
the last list you gave with BP, which pushed one of these patents for something like a link. Yeah, BT claims they have a patent for hyperlink, and they did go out in court and sue people.
Yes, and I know that this does happen. Remember, I didn't say it doesn't happen. I said it doesn't happen often, and they usually get bad publicity, black eyes, as BT has, for that sort of thing. They think it's worth it because it's probably worth enough money. But I'm not going to defend BT. I don't like BT very much. And I will try and defend the people that I have been working with personally, which mostly means individuals, not companies, just to be clear. I think if you look at, having talked with, you know, Carl Hutzler of AOL, who's their director of anti-spam, great example. Lots and lots of spam, quote, comes from AOL. It doesn't. It comes from other places. It just claims to be from AOL. Okay, you cannot trash AOL because some bozo you know, that BT, let's say, is claiming to be from a Hillel. You know, and that's the vast majority of it that I've seen. Now, there's some, of course. Comcast was particularly bad. Comcast has finally figured out that maybe they really ought to block port 25 so that people can't just arbitrarily spam from wherever. And it's a problem with viruses as well. Yes.
Eric, do you have any comments on e-voting in the real world?
E-voting.
This might be really a voting issue, but that might be the real issue there.
To be honest, I have some friends who have worked on e-voting and so forth, but I can't claim to really know anything about it. So I'm, especially given that I'm now 45 minutes into Kirk's hour, I feel like I should not speculate at this time. We should probably actually give poor Kirk a chance because he might actually want to say something. Would you?
Well, yeah.
Okay, well, I think Kirk's suggestion is we take a short break here, or do you just want to leap right in?
No. I
should
call this leap in.
Okay. He will leap in.
Yeah. Kirk.
We're going to try to wrap up the meeting by 4:15 around then, and then we're actually going to go to One Tent in Amsterdam, right? Amsterdam?
Yep.
B&T's, the pizza place over there, just so people know. Join. You actually might be able to fit most of the stuff.
Zero
reservation
for
50. 50?
Okay, cool.
Wait.
I know as well.
I'm sorry. That's definitely one of the longer miles in 50. Okay, so some of you may feel a need to use the restroom. So if you're wondering where it is, you go sort of spiraling down the stairs, one sort of half level below where the vending machines are. Right there is where the bathrooms are. So if you need to like wander out there, and I won't hold it against you. I wouldn't want to sit in these rock hard chairs for 2.5 hours without some kind of a break. Okay, so I'm not going to have any slides at all. This is one of my just sort of fun talks. So I just sort of ramble on. It's sort of going to be a mix of sort of history of BSD and reminiscing and you know, I want to talk a little bit about the pre-BSD community and how it operates, since there seem to be a fair number of people here that, of the random sample that I tested, that actually are sort of more over in the Linux side of things than BSD. So talk a little bit about the different development models there. But I'm going to start winding the clock way, way, way back to the mid-1970s when I first got to Berkeley. And I actually came in as an electrical engineer. I had studied digital design, but I found myself more interested in sort of microcode, and so I decided maybe some computer science would be an interesting thing to do. And in particular, compilers really seemed to strike me as something interesting, because even in those days we knew that assembly language was on the way out. And I really liked assembly language, so if I could write the program that converted real language into assembly language, then I could still use my assembly language skills. So compilers really appealed to me from that perspective. So I landed in an office. Graduate students, at least in Berkeley, were packed about 6 students per office. There were 3 desks, so each desk was shared by 2 people.
So the senior grad students were probably 6 people.
Yeah. And we had a few, in those days, terminals, and there was a plug board in the mailroom. They didn't have enough ports on the computers that every graduate student terminal could be connected, so you had to go into the mailroom and plug from your desk into one of the available ports on one of the machines, and there was this little probe that you could supposedly use to test whether or not a port was in use, but at times you'd find that you'd be typing along and it would suddenly stop, and it wasn't because the machine had crashed, but because someone was trying to grab your port. Anyway, a little more primitive than what we have today. So one of the other students in my office was this guy you may have heard of. His name is Bill Joy.
And Bill was also studying compilers under the same professor. Both of us were studying under Susan Graham. And but Bill was one of these people, he would just sort of, literally, his attention would go from thing to thing to thing. And so, you know, compilers were interesting, but, you know, then this Unix thing had showed up. They've gotten a PDP 1145. And Ken Thompson, who's also a Berkeley alumnus, had come back from the labs and did a one-year sabbatical at Berkeley. So he had just finished up and had been sort of the person who'd been getting the PDP 1145 really going. And so there sort of needed to be someone else that would take it over. We call that system administration today, but we didn't really have that moniker in those days. But, you know, dumps had to be done, and the tape heads had to be cleaned, and et cetera. So Bill sort of took over that as well, and so that got him interested in sort of looking at the system. He didn't really like the shell, so he wrote C shell, which is pretty amazing. If you look at the syntax of that and realize that that was written by a grad student who was studying compilers and languages, you would have thought he could have done a little better on it, but one of the things that, you know, I learned about Bill, sort of looking back over it, you know, someone once said, you know, how do you compare yourself with Bill Joy? And I look and I say, you know, there's really nothing that he did that I probably couldn't have done, but it would have taken me about 10 years to do what he would do in 1 year. He would just say, all right, here's where I am, that's where I want to get, and it would just be like, hack, 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 the shortest path from point A to point B. And that was it. Then it was done, and he'd be on to the next thing. And so there's all this just things that are left in the way, like, you know, there was the VI editor. And, you know, he started with, you know, someone else's sort of screen-based editor, and he hacked it up, got it to the point where it sort of worked. And then it took, you know, three other people the better part of 10 years to actually turn that into a program that was, like, even vaguely maintainable. I wanted to try and put the history feature into C shell, and it was one of these things where you couldn't change a line of code without breaking four things. So it was just amazing. Look at some of the videos. Anyway, I was in Bill's office, and when you were around Bill, it was just very hard not to get sort of infected with whatever it was that he was interested in. And so he became interested in the operating system. In particular, we moved over to the VACs, and we needed a virtual memory system. And so he had worked with this guy named Olzop Babagaloo, who had sort of started on one, and he sort of mashed it into the 32-bit kernel to get a paging kernel that would run on the VACs. And I sort of my first, you know, inkling that he was doing something with the operating system was when he came in one day, and in those days you still had these fanfold printed listings. That's the output media we had, and it was still a small enough program that you could actually print most of it out. And he would sort of open it up, you know, and you get two pages that were visible. And he's very animated, so he has his pencil and he's just circling in the middle of this listing. He's like, somewhere in here is a bug. I'll pay $50 to anybody that can find this bug. And, no, it's probably $20 in those days. But at any rate, you know, I sort of look at it. I'd never, of course, seen this code at all, but I had just taken taking an operating systems course, so I knew the sort of timing bugs meant that you had some sort of a race condition. And so I sort of looked through it, and I said, well, is there anything in there that can go to sleep? And he goes, that's it. And he goes running off down the hall with his listings sort of trailing along behind him to go fix it. So, you know, I never got my $20. Well, no, for a long time I didn't get my $20. Until 10 years later, I was getting an award from some of what was then Uniform, this big Unix users group, commercial Unix users group. And so they were giving awards to various people in the industry, and so they needed to find some academic, so they picked me. But, you know, it was, you know, round up the usual suspects, you know, Dennis Vichy and Bill Joy and, you know, that sort of set of people. So they were asking me, you know, oh, do you have any, you know, any stories about, you know, the early days? Yes. And I told them this story, you know, just off the cuff. And much to my chagrin, you know, the
Dennis Ritchie goes up, and they give a talk about him, and Bill Joy goes up, and so they're sitting at this table, and so I'm being sort of the academic, I'm the last one to get introduced, and so they get there, and they tell this story about how, you know, Bill had promised me $20 and hadn't given it to me, and here's Bill sitting right here at the table.
And so I sort of timidly come up onto the stage, and Bill whips a $50 bill out of his pocket and raise it in the air, and as I walk past behind him, here's your $20 with interest.
So I did eventually get my $20. Anyway, initially at Berkeley, the distributions were just, it was the Bill show. And Bill was, being a graduate student, he was doing sysadministration for the machine, which the entire department was using, and he was doing development of the Pascal compiler, the C-shell, VIEX editor, later doing development of the kernel itself. He was very good at talking to people about things. He would go out and talk this stuff up. A lot of the BSD distributions would start because he'd give these talks and say how wonderful it was and, you know, you can get it. And so people would be phoning up. You know, we had a phone in our office that was shared, of course, by all of us. And we pretty much just referred to it as the Bill Joy phone. I mean, if it rang, it was like, you know, Bill's office, you know, here, Bill. So people would be calling up. He'd be sending out tapes. He'd be verifying licenses, you know, license verification. Do you have a license? Oh, good, okay. You know, he was doing all this stuff. I mean, he had an amazing ability to just multi-process things, which staggered me. At any rate, eventually it got a sort of more formalized structure when there actually got to be some funding from DARPA to do BSD development at Berkeley. So there was actually a staff person who was hired to do the things like license verification and answering the phone and sending out tapes. And a small group of people, in particular, got up to about four people at what we call the Computer Systems Research Group. And Bill, you know, being the first one, and eventually he went off to form Sun Microsystems. And I remember he would get excited about stuff. So he came in and was all excited about this company that was starting, and he was going to be one of the founders of it. And of course, I should come with him. You know, I could get a single-digit employee number here, and there'd be great stock options. And, I was at the time about a year away from finishing my PhD, and, oh, well, you can finish your PhD while you're at the company. I'm thinking, yeah, well, that trick never works. Because it's the last year of the PhD is always the worst, because that's when you have to actually write the thing up, and it's like anything but doing that. So I explained to Bill, I said, you know, Bill, there's this company, Apollo, that's been making workstations for 3 years. They've got a lock on the applications. You know, what makes you think that this is ever going to possibly work? But I'll finish my PhD, and then we'll see how it's going. Well, it took me 18 months, not a year. And, of course, by that time, Sun was long, you know, a huge company. But so don't ask me for financial advice about startup. So instead, I took over running the CSRG when I graduated, and as I said, we built up to a core of about four people, and Bill has sort of set up an ethos of promoting the stuff and getting people to contribute things to the distribution, and so we really just sort of continued that. When you've got four people, there's not that much that four people can do. And so you really are dependent on other people helping you out. And so what would end up happening is that we would largely be dealing with code that other people would be sending to us. We would be reviewing it, sending back suggestions to them, making changes to try and integrate it into our system and dropping these things in. So if you look at the early CSRG distributions, we had sort of the kernel and the sort of core 100 utilities that came from the base Unix system, and then there was probably another 300 to 400 other things that we added in, and those were coming from other people. We obviously didn't write those all ourselves. So we had this coordination effort, and one of the problems you have is, of course, tracking because who gave you stuff and making sure you've got releases to distribute it and things like that. And so one of the very early tools that we got in about 1979 or 1980 was the source code control system, or SCCS. which oven by itself was a very Baroque interface, but luckily Eric actually wrote the SECS front end, which was just sort of a single command that would then use these different separate disparate commands and sort of make it all work and be happy. And so this turned out to be a huge boon, because now we could actually track where things came from and when changes got made. And when you've got 400 or 500 programs and something's broken, you don't necessarily remember who sort of is responsible for it. So you could just go look at the SECS logs. The rule became, whoever checked the last thing in was owned it. So you had to be really think carefully whether you wanted to check something in, because basically if your name got on it, you were responsible. So what we ended up then doing is it got to the point where there was sort of too much stuff coming in, and there were particularly sort of a set of people that we knew were doing good stuff. We really didn't have to review their work very much, and it was just causing us a lot of grief to have to constantly be updating their programs. So shortly after we got up on the ARPANET, which would have been about 82 or 83, we started giving these trusted people accounts on our machines so that they could directly check stuff into their programs to SECS. And we would just sort of let things run pretty loosey-goosey during what we would sort of consider the development cycle. And then as we were getting ready to do a distribution, which we would do about every 18 to 24 months, we would sort of have a lockdown where we say, okay, we're going to now review things. And we would actually do a diff from the previous distribution and the current one. And we'd just look at all the changes. And, if we didn't understand something, we would go ask whoever had done that, what's going on here. And so then that was essentially how we were ensuring that weird stuff wasn't getting put into the system. And so what we ended up with was something that looks like sort of a miniature version of what we have today. We have the sort of four of us that were at the center of the storm. We had a set of anywhere from 20 to 30 people that had accounts on the machine and were actively working on things. And then each of them would have about 10 people that they would be coordinating getting things in. And that model of sort of development really formed the backbone of the structure, if you will, the basis for the way that the BSD projects work today. So let me use the FreeBSD community as an example. The NetBSD community is very similar in style as is OpenBSD. But since it's the FreeBSD is the system that I actually work in personally most of the time, it's the one I'm most familiar with. So, what is this community? Well, unlike the CSRG, we don't have a paid staff at the top to sort of coordinate things. So it's a little harder to actually make it work, because it's essentially an all-volunteer organization. And volunteers have properties that fit the moniker of employees. First of all, unlike an employee, they only do what they want to do. An employee is paid to come in and the boss says, you are going to do X, and they do X, or they get replaced. But with volunteers, you can't say, well, we need X done. You can say we need it done, but if that doesn't interest them, it doesn't happen. And so you have to essentially play a game of sort of trying to find people that will fill all the pieces that need to be done. Another aspect of volunteers is that their work on FreeBSD is their lowest priority. That comes after work, it comes after their families, it comes after their vacations. Like, it fills in the little holes. And if there's a crisis at work, their work on FreeBSD comes to a complete and utter halt, possibly for an indeterminate amount of time. And so, again, what the sort of effect of this is that you can't have a schedule for any particular volunteer. You can set a schedule for the project, but you can't expect the schedule to come out of a volunteer. It's like, when is that going to get done? Well, it's going to get done when it's done. And that's, may or may not fit into any plans that you may have. The last thing is that volunteers are transient. I mean, if you look at people that are involved in the project, a lot of people get all fired up about something and they come in and they do it, and they may get fired up about another project and they will do it. But in general, their enthusiasm sort of wears off. They continue to use the system typically, but the amount of work that you're doing is fairly minimal. And so you've got to have a mechanism for having people move through the project. You know, with an expectation that they're going to come in, they're going to do some stuff, and then they're going to essentially leave. And otherwise, you're just going to build up this incredible amount of dead wood, and it's going to be like this ship that's just going to slowly sink for until you've got too much ballast. On the other hand, nobody likes to be told, oh, you have to leave, you're not doing any work. So you need to set up a mechanism whereby it's just the natural thing that happens is that you just sort of have a way of retirement. And in 3BSD, that retirement is driven by the fact that if you don't do any commits for a year, you just fall off the committer list. Now, if I didn't want to come back and start doing it again, it's trivial to get yourself reinstantiated, but absent doing that, you fall out of the project. And so you keep the people that are viewed as the committers are people that are actually actively doing things. Okay, so what are the goals? I already said that it has to be self-organizing because you don't have any paid staff, you don't have paid managers. It's not completely true because there are some companies that depend enough on FreeBSD that they essentially hire people whose job it is to essentially do stuff for FreeBSD, albeit things that are directly relevant to the company at hand. So someone like Robert Watson really effectively is sort of like having a paid manager, but he isn't. The volunteers don't view him as having any more power particularly than anybody else. Another one of the goals that I think that the BSD community has managed to pull off in a way that the Linux community is learning but isn't yet there is that you want to have a system that's egalitarian and merit-based advancement. So I'm going to talk about the structure and compare it to the Linux organization. But in particular, you should, in order to move up through the ranks, you shouldn't have to know Linus Torvalds or one of his lieutenants personally in order to be able to get things committed into the system. Same story. It's not who you know, but rather you show that you know what you're doing, you'll be given a commit bid. And if you become active enough, you can move into the core group. And there's, it's not sort of the old boys network of, you can only do this if you happen to know somebody who's already in core. It doesn't work that way. It's also important because if you're going to have an organization that's going to survive in the long term, you can't simply have individual figureheads. I mean, at some point, Linus is going to get hit by a truck, or he's going to retire, or he's going to leave the scene, and there has to be some structure that's going to take over and see that stuff gets done. I mean, the classic one is where there was a huge security hole that showed up in Linux, and Linus was on vacation for 2 weeks and didn't have any communication mechanism, and they were paralyzed about fixing it until he got back. Now that sort of a thing is dealt with today because there's enough companies whose bottom line is going to be hurt very badly by that, but they've now fixed that particular problem. But it's symptomatic of something where you don't have one of these sort of self-organizing things. Okay, and the other goal, of course, is anticipating turnover and managing it gracefully, the dealing with dead wood issue. Okay, so let me talk about sort of the organization. There's sort of four rings, if you will, and at the outer ring, we have the users. At the end of the day, you want to have a system that's got users. It's not particularly interesting to have something that runs on your desk and nowhere else. And so you want to be able to draw in the users, and in particular, you want to give them the sense that they can at least, if they want to, find out what's going on. So you want to have a bug tracking system where if a user discovers some kind of a bug, they can send in a report about it. And the users, it's not like a black hole. When you send in a bug report to your favorite vendor, it sort of disappears into the vendor, and maybe someday, if you're lucky, a response comes out. Whereas if you look at FreeBSD, you send in a bug report, you're told, all right, this is the bug report number. You can go up on the web, you can pull up that bug report number, you can see who it's been assigned to, you can see about any comments that are going on about trying to fix it. But does this mean that stuff gets done in a prompt fashion? No. Are there bugs that have been sitting there for years? Yes. If it's something that's important, it tends to get driven through, and you can at least see what's going on. You can see that nothing is happening, and you can rabble-rouse if you need to try and get stuff moving along on the things that you care about. There's mailing lists. And again, the users have access to those mailing lists. They can't post to all of them, but they can certainly read nearly all of them, and they can post to many of them. Okay, so the users come in, and they sort of see your system from the outside, and of course, most of them never do anything other than use it. But a certain number of them become interested enough that they actually want to start working on bits and pieces of it. And so they move into the next inner ring, which I'll call the developer ring. And the developers have read access to the source code and the CVS logs. Unlike Berkeley, where we did these distributions every 2 years, and that's basically what you got to see, and unless you had the equivalent of a commit bit, you couldn't, i.e. you could log onto the machine, you couldn't see the source code log. With CVS, these things are read-only copies, are spread all over the world. You can essentially look at them, they're updated within a few hours of the CVS log being changed, so you can really track what's going on if you choose to do that. Now, of course, you can't change them, but you can look and see who's working on a particular piece of code to get some idea who maybe you should be talking to, and perhaps even start making some suggestions. So if you actually come up with something where you want to make a change to the system, you don't have the right to change the source log. So you've got to find someone in the next inner ring, which I'll call the committers. So developers are sort of working on the periphery. They have to find, if you get something put in the system, they have to find a committer. Now, there are, at the moment, about 300 committers. And so it's not like it's hard to find one of these people. Second of all, their names are scattered all through the CVS logs. So if you're working on some particular program, you go look who's been making commits to that particular program over the last few months or years. And you have a pretty good idea who you need to talk to. So you can, send them some mail and say, I've been looking at, whatever, and I thought I found this bug, and here's my suggested fix. And for the most part, they will be interested, responsive, etc., particularly if you can, do more than complain that something's not working, here's the bug, and here's a way to reproduce it, and here's my suggested fix. Now, what will tend to happen is that they'll take that and they'll, restructure it to make it look like the way they think it ought to be. So you can sort of see how they drop the code in. But once you start working with them, you begin to get a feeling for the flavor of the way the source code is organized and the structure and the way coding styles, etc. So what happens is, as developers become more active, they start sending more and more stuff to the committers, and eventually the committer, as we did at Berkeley, gets tired of spending half the time putting other people's stuff in, and so they will eventually suggest that they will nominate you to become a committer yourself. And here what happens is that in order to become a committer, you've got to find at least one other committer, preferably two, that will put your name into nomination, and then there's the core that I haven't talked about yet, but they will look at that nomination and they pretty much rubber stamp it. And if committers come and say, this person should get a commit bit and I will be his mentor, which basically means if he does something really stupid, it reflects badly on me, they then become a committer. Compare this to trying to get something into Linux. Essentially, you have to either get Linus to put it in or one of his four lieutenants, typically, to hand it to Linus to put it in. And one of the stories that I have is this person who'd been trying to work on the scheduler in Linux. It had some, about 4 years ago, had some fairly serious problems. He really just sort of wanted to overhaul it. But he fairly quickly discovered that nobody was going to just, out with the old and with the new. He, as he, in his words, I had to spoon feed them diffs that were no more than 50 lines, because if it was more than 50 lines, they wouldn't consider it. And so he had to find a way to get from point A to point B 50 lines at a time. So he'd go, and he did eventually get that last sort of hump, over that last sort of hump. It took him, he said, just shy of 3 years to get that done. And so he got sort of turned off by that whole thing. And actually, I'd given a talk, this talk, more or less. And so he came and talked to me afterwards about the previous day and the way things, you know, worked. And so he became a developer and fairly quickly became a committer. And he decided that he wanted to do a lot of the same scheduling stuff in previous C, and so he just dropped the whole thing in as an alternate scheduler, and it's a compile time option, whether you have the old or the new. And I ran across him a few months ago, and he said, oh yeah, I was really impressed how quickly the stuff got put into previous C, and you know, what did I think of the schedule? I said, well, you know, the schedule that you replaced was the one that I wrote. But, you know, yours obviously, you know, it deals with a bunch of things that the old one doesn't deal with, like threads and affinity scheduling and all this nasty stuff you have to do today. So, you know, my attitude is good, you know. It's, you know, if it's 20 years old, it probably doesn't need to be replaced. So it's a somewhat different, shall we say, perspective on moving these things forward. Anyway, I'm still talking about organization here. So the committers then, you remain a committer as long as you do at least one commit a year, which is not a very high threshold to get over, because one of the things you can commit is information. You have sort of a who I am, and all you have to do is make one change in there, and that's a commit. So the hurdle is about as high as a blade of grass that's been snipped over and is lying on its side. Now, as a committer, you still need to make sure that the things stay coherent and that there's some reviewing going on. And the way this tends to get, the rules for doing this are, first of all, you're given a commit bit, but it doesn't mean that you have free rein over doing anything you want anywhere in the system. Now, any of you that have used CVS know that CVS doesn't really have a way of saying, well, you can do this, but not that. But if you get a commit bit for, let's say, send mail, it doesn't mean that you can go change the kernel. It, however, is on the honor system. That is, it's listed what you're supposed to be working, what you've said you're going to be doing. And if you say you don't have kernel on that list and you start making changes to the kernel, red flags are going to go up and people are going to say, what's going on here? Which means that you can potentially lose your commit bit. The other thing is that when you're going to make a change to some part of the core system, you can't just do that on your own. You have to get at least one other committer to review it. And I cannot go in and change the previous file system kernel without getting at least one other committer to look at what I'm doing and say, yeah, that's a reasonable thing to do. And this is a good thing because, you're getting some review, and the amount of the feedback that I've gotten has been invaluable. It's like, well, did you consider this or that, or that isn't going to work on the alpha because you forgot about this. And so having that level of peer review is important. It also means that you can't get away with sloppy coding, i.e. not following the kernel normal form coding standards or whatever the coding standard is for the program that you're working on. Because the reviewers, if they have to look at it and it doesn't match the code, they're gonna whine about it, and they're gonna give you pushback until you fix it. And so the net effect is that the code base has stayed remarkably clean. If you look at most commercial software that's 25 years old, you would be hard pressed to want to do anything other than put it onto a garbage scow. And because of the fact that people actually pay attention to things. And the other thing is, because of the fact that we don't have to have backward compatibility forever, we can say, this is obsolete, we are going to throw it out. And you just wholesale pick it up and toss it and replace it with new code. And that is valuable because there's just different ways that you do things today than you did them 25 years ago. And so being able to just wholesale chuck stuff out really has helped keep the code base a lot cleaner. Okay, so Finally, we have a core. You've got to have somewhere that the buck stops. But you get committers that get in altercations with each other as to how something ought to be done, and you need somebody to act as a sort of third party that's going to decide how it ultimately gets resolved. And so for this purpose, there is a core, so-called core team, and they are responsible for the administrative stuff like turning on and off commit bits, for sort of keeping track of or arbitrating disputes among committers or developers, and for generally supposedly having a grand architecture view of the system, which they actually do sometimes and don't do sometimes. At any rate, the core is nominated from and elected by the committers every 2 years. So in order to be a core member, you have to first be a committer. You have to be you can self-nominate, but you typically are nominated by several core people who actually, you know, say, I nominate this person. And then you need to, there's usually 20 or 25 people that are running for it, and then you elect 9 for that, and then they serve for 2 years. And if they do a good job, they likely be reelected. If they aren't doing a good job or they're burned out, which is very common, but it's sort of it uses up a lot of your time and it's not coding and people sort of get bored with it. The upshot is that we, as a practical matter, see a turnover of about half of core every 2 years. But the real point is that they're coming out of the committers, so they're people that obviously know what's going on now. They have to be elected by the committers, so they have to have at least passable people skills. If they piss off everybody in sight, they're not going to get themselves elected. This is a good thing because their role is things where they're trying to coordinate these folks. So you get a certain number of the committers who are really there because it's a popularity contest, but you also get a certain, at least half of them that are there that are seriously understand what's going on with the project and are really committed to trying to make some of that stuff work. Again, because it's an elected position, it's a sort of up and out. If they turn into dead wood, they won't be reelected. And so, again, it's a way of taking these people that are at the very top and having a graceful way of letting them have an exit. Like, all right, your term is up, you don't run again, it's not like someone has to come in and say, oh, you're doing a bad job, we're getting rid of you. That just isn't going to work in a volunteer organization anyway. So it's this whole thing of anticipating turnover and managing it gracefully. So that, in essence, is the way that the community is organized, and it has worked very well. It has grown, obviously, dramatically from the size that we had in the time of the CSRG. And sort of interesting to see, how far can we really push this? Part of what happened with Linux is it turned into a success disaster. It suddenly started growing so fast and in so many ways that they sort of lost their way in trying to figure out how to do things because it just blew up. When you have a single person who's in charge of something like that, they become the limiting factor in getting stuff done. And you need to have some way of growing the thing in a graceful way. So FreeBSD hasn't had the misfortune of having one of these periods of extreme growth over a very short period of time. It's just been sort of a slow, steady growth. And that's been good. But the question is, how far can it go where this structure is going to continue to work? We have over 300 committers now, and still growing as 20 or 40 a year net. There's bunches that fall off the back of the wagon, but more are coming in. At some point, it's going to get sort of too big to manage. We're going to need sort of another level of hierarchy in here, and I'm not quite sure where we get it at this point. At least we have the benefit that it's not growing so fast that we aren't going to have some chance to realize where things are falling apart. So, for example, CORE didn't used to be elected. It was just monarchy for life, and we had a bunch of people in CORE that were deadwood and weren't getting stuff done, but they were essentially blocking the other people from moving up, and that's where we went to having things elected, and that really helped focus CORE and make CORE work well. And so I think that's going to continue to work. But what may have to happen is that the committers may have, we may actually have to bifurcate them into different groups. Because there really are sort of a set of people that are working on kernel and what I'll call core utilities. The vast majority of committers are actually working in the ports area, where they're really just sort of maintaining a few programs that are being sort of developed on the outside and brought in. So somebody is tracking SendMail and bringing it in. Somebody is tracking Apache and bringing it in. They're not really doing development on it, but they're making sure that, you know, there's a version that will download and compile and run on FreeBSD. And, you know, it's just what I want every night it goes through and makes sure that nothing has caused that to break. And so that set of people really doesn't need to coordinate real closely with the people that are doing the, you know, the core development. And so it may be possible to break it up in that way. The other thing that's been sort of interesting, a group that's coming lately into FreeBSD, are the documentation group. And this is a really, I think it's a feather in the cap of the FreeBSD community, that they're able to attract people that are willing to do this kind of stuff. These are people that are interested in the technology but are not themselves typically programmers. And they instead look at this stuff, try and figure out how it works, and document it. And you know, the documentation for FreeBSD has improved dramatically since this group of people, which isn't very big, it's about 15 people, but you know, they're committers, but all they commit to is documentation. And that's again, a sort of a subgroup. They obviously need to have access to the committers because they need to talk to them about stuff, and God knows they find enough bugs and things. Again, it's sort of a sub-piece that could be pushed off in another direction. So, at any rate, I guess sort of the last thing I want to say about the community is, you know, it's growing slowly and has more or less been growing at about the same rate for the last 10 years. Where are these people coming from? And so I did it when I was writing the introduction to my book. I wanted to try and figure out where they were coming from. So I did a very unofficial survey where I just sort of went around and looked at sent some email to the last 30 people that had come in and gotten commit bits, and you know, said, you know, give me a thumbnail sketch of who you are and what you've done and how you came to be in FreeBSD. And what I, you know, sort of demographic that I got from this very scientific study is that they tend to be people that are in their mid to late 20s. Most of them have been working in the open, in some open source, typically Linux, for the last 10 years by the time they come to FreeBSD. And they have tended to come to FreeBSD because of the way the project is structured and the feeling that, you know, I'm a big boy now and I really want to be able to have an impact, and this is a community in which I'm going to be able to do that. So it's, you know, sort of interesting to see that. Okay, so I'm going to finish my talk here at this point, but I will be happy to take questions or carry on any other discussions. I have a 2.5-hour FreeBSD talk that I can give, but obviously I'm not going to do that here. But if there's specific things you want to ask about, I'll be glad to jump in on. We'll start all the way in the back.
Earlier you mentioned the example of the security patch in Linux that required Linus's intervention to roll out.
Yeah.
Can you speak a bit about how you work around that in FreeBSD from either a perspective of the core team or from a release engineering perspective of actually rolling out
The core team actually has a set of committees. It sounds like a board of directors. And so one of the committees, really, it's a person, is the security manager. It's not security manager.
Officer.
Yes, security officer, I believe they call him. And when a security issue comes up, particularly something that's either in the kernel or a critical utility, it is his, typically, he will coordinate whatever kind of a response will happen. If for whatever reason he is not able to do it, there's a sort of a hierarchy of people that are, you know, on the core team will essentially pick somebody else to deal with it. So the problem needs to be identified, and when it's identified, it, you know, whatever the area that it's in, it becomes fairly evident. So if it's something, let's say, in an external utility like SSH, Obviously, FreeBSD isn't going to typically be leading the charge for that. Rather, CEO or someone from OpenBSD that's maintaining our utility will be the one that will come up with the blessed patch. So really, that's just a matter of tracking when that's gotten done, getting that into the CVS system for FreeBSD. I didn't talk about the structure of the distributions, but there's the active or current distribution, which is the bits du jour, whatever that has been hacked up in the last N minutes. Most people don't run that. Developers run that because that's what they're working on usually. But people that are normally running FreeBSD don't do that. And then there's the stable branch. So periodically, current will be forked off and a new stable branch will be built. And then there will be releases on that stable branch. So right now, there's sort of the stable branch that most people are running on is still the 4.x branch. So 4.10, I guess, just came out fairly recently. They're working on creating the 5.x branch, but that's hasn't stabilized enough that people are really quite ready to go to that yet. And current, of course, is still carrying on being current. So what will happen is that the patch will first be put into current to check that it works. Normally, the rule of thumb is it stays there for a week to be tested. If it's a critical security patch, particularly if it's a small patch that you can really convince yourself, this isn't going to have other bad effects, it will then, a corresponding patch will be put into the stable branch. And you can download stable at any time. Periodically, there will be distributions cut roughly every 6 months or so. So there'll be 4.1, 4.2, 4.3, 4.4, 4.5, and so on. But you don't have to wait for that branch to come out. You can simply download stable. So what will typically happen is it'll go into current, it'll be validated there. Once it's been validated, usually after a week, the corresponding change will be made into stable, and then out on the mailing list will be a notification saying this security thing has been found, the stable as of such and such a date and time contains the fix for it. And so you then download that and install it as a user. Yes?
I'm glad you brought up the work of the documentation people, because it's often overlooked and it's been a real shortcoming for a long time and everywhere. Are there any interesting aspects of how the documentation is done at Berkeley? And I don't know, were there any problems involved with dealing with AT&T owning part of the documentation, whether it got incorporated or not, and that kind of thing? I don't want to belabor that if there's nothing interesting to say.
I could carry on for quite a long time on that topic, but let me just take a couple comments. One was, one of the things that we set up at Berkeley was that you are responsible for a particular subsystem. To just take a random example, say the file system. And if there was a bug, then it didn't matter whether it was a utility, if it was the top half of the kernel, if it was the bottom half of the kernel, or if it was the manual page. One-stop shopping. That person's responsible for fixing it, or documenting it, or whatever. So, in essence, we required our developers to also do documentation. This worked in the Berkeley context. It doesn't really work in the bigger context that we find ourselves today, because there are, quite frankly, people that couldn't write their way out of a wet paper bag, given a sharp pencil. The upshot of that is that you either have documentation that is non-existent, minimal, or shoddy, and so it's been, as I say, a breath of fresh air that there's people that, essentially, for them, technical writing is something which they find interesting and exciting. That is, they're willing to do it on a volunteer basis to clean up a lot of these things and trace down these developers and find out what's really going on or look at the code or whatever. As for the AT&T thing, for the most part, they did the right thing. Yeah.
You mentioned about the different branches for the PBSD kernel.
Yeah.
Is there a regression testing process that goes on, or is it
But how do you deem that something is stable or production ready? Do all the committers get together and say, okay, committer number two didn't put a bug in that has pre-productions to what I'm working on? I mean, is there a testing suite or a regression testing process?
Historically, there has been no regression testing. In the last few years, there's started to be regression testing, at least for parts of the kernel and some of the more important utilities. And a lot of the outside developers, like Apache folks, have an incredible regression test that they run against their applications. So on an application-by-application basis, it's somewhat mixed. It's certainly an area that deserves more attention than it's gotten. The historic way that it has worked and the way which is still a significant component to the way that it gets done is the having things go through stages. So have something go into current first, where you have active developers. First of all, you see that stuff going in. You know, anyone that's got a commit bid is on a mailing list that automatically gets the CVS commit messages sent to them. So you see that stuff going by, you're aware of that happening, and those systems are being used at least on test machines. Then, before something can go into stable, first of all, it's not everything that goes into current goes into stable. A lot of stuff is just sort of new functionality, and that's just it. The only things that come over into stable are bug fixes, or for example, an update to a device driver to make it work with new version X of the device. So the first way that you ensure that the stability is maintained is to sort of minimize the number of things that get RFC, essentially brought over from current. And secondly, you have a set of people that will do very serious testing on those things before they get put into the stable branch, because there's a lot of people that are depending on that in production use, and if you put something in there that's going to cause trouble, that's just that's your death now. If you're the committer of an RFC that causes bad things to happen to the production system, you get a very, very big black mark over your head. So you just, I personally will no longer RFC things. I will get somebody else to do it. So knows the rigmarole of what goes on there. And knows how the testing is done and knows who needs to be notified and do the tests and so on. Because I once put something in which it didn't cause huge havoc, but it caused minor havoc. And I just realized that I wasn't in tune enough with the whole process and who needed to be notified, I just had no business doing that.
Is there a committee or consensus of the committers?
Yeah, there's the release engineering group, which is another group that's driven off of core, but is actually made up mostly of committers. Their real role is maintaining that stable branch and RFCing things and pulling together the dot releases as they're being done.
Sure. Depending how a lot of people download current every day, build it overnight, and then run it the next day, and that's what they're developing under.
Yeah.
And then they send feedback to somebody if they find a bug in a particular subsystem.
Yeah, I found
a bug in the network stuff at one point, and I just sent it to the author. This is the conditions I produced it under. See if you can reproduce it.
My test machine every night downloads current, does a make world, and reboots itself. And I come in the morning, and most mornings it's running. Every now and then.
Back.
Yeah.
Just curious, what do you
branch it's going to happen when it gets stable enough, is the bottom line. And so you're asking when it's going to get stable enough. I have been sort of out of the loop of that. I spent 15 months basically writing the FreeBSD book. And the only way you get something like that done is not to do anything else, because almost anything else is more interesting. And so I sort of deliberately just took myself offline. And so I haven't been following that. I have five critical bug reports I just discovered as I was flying here and was finally starting to get caught up on my mail. I have 5 critical bug reports in the 5.x series that have been assigned to me. So that have to do mostly with snapshots causing trouble. And also one soft updates one, which I'm not quite sure what's going on with. So you can point the finger at me as being at least part of the problem in getting that to be conversation. But I'm going to work on that pretty soon because I'm done with my book now. Thank you. Yeah.
Just
spend a minute talking about JT's lawsuit and give us a snapshot of what was there, what's happened, what's become of that issue now, and where things go from here. Do you have any of the history of the recent FCO stuff? Well, just that's a replay. Same story all over again. Let's see. How can I do this? What I want is sort of the executive summary here because it's about a 45-minute lecture if I do it all out. All right. So CSRG had been asked to start releasing things under a different license. Traditionally, under the CSRG, we had started with Unix 32V, and we had added a bunch of stuff to it, but we had never differentiated what was 32V and what it was that we had added. And so in order to get BSC from the university, you had to first go get yourself a source license from AT&T, and then we would sell you our tape. And that was fine when the licenses were cheap. But the cost of the licenses started going up and up and up, and were becoming unreasonable for many, especially educational institutions, to get their minds wrapped around. And as the PC was starting to come out and people wanted to do things like build a card you could plug into a PC that would give you a TCP IP stack, they really couldn't afford a full Unix license just in order to be able to get the TCP IP code. So we've been asked to differentiate the AT&T code from the BSC code, the CSRG code. And our first attempt at that was in 1988 when we released Networking Release 1. And went through and said, all right, well, 32V clearly didn't have any networking in it other than UUCP. And so, and that wasn't in the kernel at all. So we could just pull the whole TCP IP stack out and the utilities that went with it, the infamous R commands, R login, RSH, et cetera, along with things like FTP and Telnet and so on. So we put those together. We changed the license on those to be what we now canonically call the Berkeley license. And that was a wild success. It was essentially, do whatever you want. You know what the license is. So we figured that we would sell about 3 or 4 tapes for $1,000 a pop, and then people would just get it, and that would be that. But a lot of companies were more than willing to pay the $1,000 to basically get a license from the university saying, this is ours, and you can do whatever you want with it, and we say so. So we actually sold hundreds of these tapes. Often people would say, well, just send the license, you don't actually need to send the tape. So I guess I should say we sold hundreds of licenses in a few days. Anyway, that was a wild success, and we sort of thought, well, that's the end of it. But Keith Bostick was one of the people that worked with me at Berkeley, and now of Sleepy Cat Software, and Mike Carls is another one of the people in our group, and so we would have these meetings once a week, and so we're having this weekly meeting, and Tim and Mike and me and probably Keith Sklauer, and Keith says, well, I guess I should say what Keith's job was. We hired him. One third of his job was to provide technical support on the phone, so if someone would call in had actually a question about code as opposed to getting a license, they'd be transferred to Keith. One third was to deal with all the various email traffic that would come into the project, answering questions and blah, 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 handling external liaisons, like getting people to do contributions and getting their forms and all that. And one third of it was to actually get to do some programming, because we figured if we didn't give him that as part of his job description, he wouldn't take the job. And so he did these 3 jobs, sort of 3 full-time jobs. He didn't really have a life at that time. And so he comes into this and he says, well, you know, a lot of people have been saying, you know, they really like Network Release 1, but can we get some other stuff too? And we're like, well, you know, it's all intermixed, and how are we going to figure it out? And, you know, we finally, Mike and I, you know, Keith is just banging away and banging away and banging away. So Mike and I figured, well, we'll put this bit to rest. We say, Keith, well, if you can figure out how to deal with the libraries and all the utilities, Mike and I'll deal with the kernel. And we figured, that's it. There's 500 utilities. We're done. So Keith rises to the challenge. We're at the next Usenix conference, and we have these birds of a feather session where we get up and report what we've been doing. And he'd get up, and he'd have this list of all the commands. And he'd say, you know, we're trying to get these commands rewritten. You know, and so for, you know, fame and fortune, you can rewrite one of these, you know, and you can figure out how to get the fortune, but we'll give you the fame by putting your name up in lights, you know, like so-and-so rewrote the cat command, you know. And Mike and I are like, oh, yeah, well, we'll get cat and maybe LS and then what? But anyway, so as each music community go on, there'd be more and more of these programs that would be checked off. And it's, you know, after about 18 months of this, he came in, and we look up, and what do we see checked off? But EQN, TBL, PROF, etc. It's like, you've got to be kidding. Somebody rewrote that stuff? And I looked at Mike, and Mike looked at me, and we realized we're going to have to do something about that kernel. So, well, the kernel, you can't just put it, say, you know, someone rewrite the kernel, we'll just put your name up in lights. That doesn't really work that way. So we actually had to go through and figure out what was ours and what had come from 33. And it's not as easy as you think because, you know, you sort of cut and paste. So you just, like, grab something here and it, you know, something might have been, you know, in the process management, but it ended up in a device driver or something. I mean, it's just, how do you find all that stuff and figure out where it came from? So Keith Ever, rising to this sort of challenge, says, well, we've got 32V. We've got these big computers, you know, these one MIP faxes. We will just build... We'll take the 32V kernel, we will run it through the beautifier, put it in a canonical form, and then we will build an inverted database against it. And then we will take the entire BSD kernel, we will run it through the beautifier, put it in the same canonical form, and then we will look every line of that up in this inverted database to see if we get runs of lines that match, that aren't just like braces and, you know, stuff, white noise. And by golly, it was just like, you know, a four-alarm fire, you know. And stuff could just, it really migrated all over the place. But there were just like little brush fires, like here and there. There'd be like a file of 1,000 lines, and there'd be like two places where there'd be like 5 or 6 lines. And it's usually, you know, some sort of stupid linear scan of some table, and it just happens to use the same lane variables and blah, blah, blah. Anyway, a lot of those things you just say, well, first of all, you know, that code looks horrible, and second of all, it shouldn't be using a, you know, a linear search through the entire process table. Or anyway, you know, we hashed the process table eons ago. Why aren't we using a hash lookup there? So you just yank the linear search out and drop in and call it a hash lookup. So we did all that, and when that dust settled, we only had 6 files left. And even those, we probably could have cleaned up, but we figured, you know, if we put the entire system out, AT&T is likely to, like, That might just sort of push him over the edge. So we'll just stop here, you know, and then maybe that will be the next thing we'll do later. So we put out, you know, the C library, the utilities that we had. I mean, there were some things like the thing that wrote the floppy disk in the console controller for the VAX we didn't have. It's like, well, I guess we'll leave that one. So we put together this system and we put it out. And that we... Every time you want to change something with the lawyers at Berkeley, it's like a year of arguing about stuff. So we just said, we'll just call it networking release too. Because that way we just tell them we're using the same license, we're just changing a new release of it. We did, of course, have to go through and get approval to do this through the university channels, and that was a fair amount of work. And in fact, they brought in outside people to look at how we've done it and verify that they have not goofed up. And so we put it out. And it was sort of okay. I mean, you know, initially AT&T didn't really seem to mind too much. Until BSDI came along. So a commercial company came along and started touting the fact that they would sell you complete source for your system for a 99% discount over what AT&T would sell for. And they didn't really think much of that. So at that point, they filed a lawsuit against BSDI, actually. And BSDI said, well, we've added these six files, so we're willing to discuss any of these six files with you. But all the rest of it just came from the university. So if you don't like it, don't complain to us. And the judge more or less agreed with them. So then they were forced to sue the university and BSDI. And now you had, you know, two Goliaths going at it. So that went back and forth for a while. And that's sort of a long and interesting story, but I won't do that one here. The upshot of it was that Ray Norda of Novell bought the rights to Unix, and his attitude, at least as publicly stated, was he preferred to compete in the marketplace rather than in the courtroom. And so he essentially told them to settle it, and it got settled, and that was that. Yes.
Totally different space. The BSD data, the actual.
The little guy.
On your short.
Yeah.
Yeah. Where did that where that come from for you and why is it around today? Because that penguin, the business guys like penguin. That's not just grand. A little devil. Oh,
well, it actually, to really understand it, you have to go all the way back to the predecessor to Unix, which was Multics. Multics was, I won't say the first operating system, but it's the first that I'm aware of, where you had processes that weren't directly started by the users, but just ran in background and did stuff on behalf of users, so-called daemon processes. And they called them daemon processes. And so when Unix came along, they similarly needed these sort of processes. And so they called them daemon processes also. And so at some point, Usenix was having their 10th anniversary. And so they wanted to do a T-shirt, and they commissioned an artist to do a drawing for that. And if you've seen it, it's a PDP-11, and then there's these sort of big pipes on that are sort of in front of it. And the first sort of images of what the artist conceived the daemon would look like, which doesn't really look very much like the one that you see today, but they're there, and they have little pitchforks and so on. So that was sort of the first instantiation of a daemon image. So when it came time to do the manuals for 4.2, some students up at, oh God, I'm going to forget the name, it's in Minnesota, college up there, at any rate, they had drawn a sort of a black and white stick figure that, again, looked a lot like the one that the original artist had done on that Usenix T-shirt. And that was, became sort of the inspiration for the next variant of the daemon. But we wanted one that was sort of a little more colorful. I mean, that was just sort of running black and white. And actually, that very first black and white one was actually done by John Lasseter, now that I think about it. But we wanted to go back to him and get him to do one that had some color to it. So Sam Loeffler, who had been with the project, had left the project by that time and was working at Lucasfilm in their computer division. And they were developing an animator's workstation. And they knew a lot about computer graphics, but they didn't really know very much about what someone that did animation would really want. It was all done pretty much by hand in those days. But John Lasseter, who was a lead animator for Walt Disney, was on a six-month sabbatical at Lucasfilm, and he was an animator. So they said, well, what do you want? So he would help them by saying, you know, as an animator, I want to be able to do this and this and this and this. And so he was helping them design the user interface for it. So Sam said, well, could you just draw us, you know, this daemon? You know, we had the little black stick, black and white one, but, you know, one that's got some verve to it. So Lasseter just got a board and chalk and just drew up with what we now think of as sort of the classic BSD daemon. And the reason it has that sort of pudgy Disney-esque look is because he was an animator for Disney, and so that's why it has that sort of look to it. And then later, when they did the 4.4 book, I again went back to him. By this time, I knew better than to let him do it with chalk on the board, because that is deteriorating despite my best efforts to preserve it. And so the one, the 4-4 book was actually done pen and ink on archival bond paper. So that's the one where he's sort of running along chasing the dwelling worm. But that's sort of the history of these things. And after the fact, I went back to John Lasseter and basically bought from him the rights. I essentially had him sign those drawings over to me as a work for hire, so that I actually have the copyright is actually held in my name with the U.S. Copyright Office, so that I can actually persecute people that use it in ways that I feel are inappropriate.
Prosecute.
Yeah. Send spam. Okay, let me try for one more question.
I know in school they teach you a monolithic operating system isn't very good. Do you have any regrets, you know, not making more microkernel or whatever?
I think that microkernels are a beautiful way to design an operating system and a horrible way to implement them. When you're developing individual pieces, having things in separate address spaces gives a lot of protection and control, just like having separate processes. But at the end of the day, the boundary crossings are so expensive for the message passing that the performance is very hard to get the performance to be what you need. There are places where they are entirely appropriate. Certainly, loosely coupled multiprocessor, you've got to have the messages flying around anyway. That's an ideal environment for that kind of an operating system. But where you're on a uniprocessor or a tightly coupled multiprocessor, the overhead of the message passing, doing the boundary crossing, it's just hard to find ways of doing it where you don't have too many boundary crossings. The approach that has worked fairly well is to design it initially with those separate modules, and then once you have sort of debugged it and you're ready to go into production, you put them all in a single address space, so you don't have to pay the boundary crossing costs. But I don't think that in production systems we're going to tend to see that. So I just wanted to show off some of my swag here. See, one of the ways I make money is I go around and I sell stuff. So. In case you haven't seen it, there's this wonderful new book out. I also have, it's an old media, it's called Videotape. I don't have it on DVD, but it's a 2.5 hour history talk, which is essentially what it's cribbed from. I have CSRG Archives. These are four CDs, which has all of the releases we ever did from Berkeley, including a CD which is the complete FCCS logs of everything for the entire duration of the project. And lastly, I have these wonderful shirts that come in blue or gray. And I only brought sort of one of each of these things. So if you really want them, you can get them off my website, which is www.mcusick.com. But I'll sell the individual things that I have here if people want them today. Thank you.
So anybody who did buy a ticket, last ticket, can start doing that right now. We have 6 books. Michael? 6?
Oh, yeah, maybe. Only 6 books. I'm going to leave out from the left, though.
6?
We have 8.
Okay. Eric, why don't you leave the house?
It's really
second in the list.
To be fair, we're going to.